celebrated Harvard Business School historian Nancy Kane's new book, Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times, spotlights five masters of crisis: polar explorer Ernest Shackleton, President Abraham Lincoln, legendary abolitionist Frederick Douglass, Nazi-resisting clergyman Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and environmental crusader Rachel Carson. What do such disparate figures have in common? Why do their extraordinary stories continue to amaze and inspire? In delivering the answers to these questions, Nancy Kane offers a template by which to judge those in our own time to whom the public has given its trust. Again, the name of the book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Nancy Kane to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a huge pleasure, Joe.
What brought you to the subject?
I'm a historian, that's the first thing, so I'm always snooping around and doing detective work in the past, looking for interesting stories. But a series of personal crises, including my husband walking out on me, my father dropping dead, and then my getting cancer twice in a short period of time, brought me to my knees and brought me to other leaders, although I didn't know their stories, brought me to other people in the past who had had great calamity around them, and I was trying to figure out how did they not only survive the storms, but then learn to thrive and have great impact on a worthy plane. So combination of personal and professional interests and needs.
So you spotlight really what you refer to as five masters of crisis. So tell us what went into that decision-making process of who these people were going to be.
So yes, it's a great question. The biggest thing, two big factors, two most important factors. First, I wanted to understand not only what they did in crisis, you know, in terms of external action and impact, but I also wanted to understand what their emotional experience was. How were they dealing with this? So I was interested in that both as a historian of leadership, right? What makes leaders tick? What is the effect of their emotional awareness on what they do in the external world? But also I was just interested as a human pilgrim. How do people get through really difficult situations with great volatility and uncertainty coming at them and surrounding them and, again, make an impact? So two key factors. One, I needed to be able to reconstruct their inner experience. So as a historian, I needed evidence of that. Well, lots and lots of people through the past have had great difficulty to deal with. The historical record they leave is often scanty or inaccessible. So I needed five people with diaries and personal notes to themselves and firsthand accounts. And secondly, I wanted a variety of people. I didn't want just political leaders. You'll notice there are no business leaders in the book, even though I'm a historian at the Harvard Business School. And so I wanted different people, different purposes, different missions, different sets of circumstances in order to draw as many diverse and relevant lessons for anyone that aspires to lead on any stage today.
So you end up with this incredible list: polar explorer Ernest Shackleton, President Abraham Lincoln, legendary abolitionist Frederick Douglass, environmental crusader Rachel Carson, and Nazi-resisting clergyman Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So that list of people, once you had it, did you want to discuss and look at what they had in common and what their differences were?
So the answer is yes, although I'm a historian, we don't work like a lot of academics or a lot of researchers. That is, we don't start from a theory. We start from the bottom up. We're working inductively, following the clues, not the money, the clues. And so I was piecing together each story one by one. And then as I did this and went back to revise each one and then revise them again, the book took me 10 years to do, so it was a long pregnancy, I discovered both really important commonalities, and the readers will discover all these common threads that run through their experiences and the lessons they learned. And then I discovered lots of interesting differences. For example, Rachel Carson is the only woman in the book, and she's the only real serious introvert in the book. And so her story, which lots and lots of women and lots of men will relate to, right, is the story of an introvert, a shy woman with great domestic caretaking responsibilities that she's also juggling as she lights the world on fire, creating the modern environmental movement.
I do find that fascinating. What is it about the fact that she is an introvert that makes her achievement even more spectacular?
So she's the last chapter of the book, and I think in some ways she's the most powerful, even though she's quiet, and she works alone, and she's shy, and she'd prefer to walk the main coastline than to click down the, you know, marble-floored halls of Congress or the federal government. I think what makes her story so powerful is that, first of all, she was willing to take on a huge number of powerful vested interests, from the FDA to the Department of Agriculture, to Dow and Monsanto, as she was trying to reconstruct what pesticides like DDT really meant for the environment. And she's willing to do that partly because she doesn't need to be surrounded by people. So the story that she puts together, which has never, ever been challenged, the credibility of which has never been challenged, that's why it was so important, it's true. The story she put together was painstaking and complicated and required years of careful research. And a person who was simply much, much more extroverted and depended on a lot of external validation and contact would never have been able to put together this kind of story with the force and truthfulness that she did. So a big piece of what makes her powerful is her willingness to do a certain kind of homework very carefully, very painstakingly. And then last but not least, she's willing to keep turning that story around, to keep checking it, to keep taking the pulse of it in a way, again, that someone who's very, very busy, as many leaders are, answering to a huge number of constituencies on a regular basis, simply could not have done.
We mentioned both President Lincoln as well as Frederick Douglass. Here are two men that are linked as well.
They are, and I didn't know much about this linkage. So they're linked in a couple of ways. One is personal. They met each other several times over the course of the Civil War and grew to like and respect each other. But the more important way they're linked is the way that they each depended on each other's actions to make the vision, the mission, end slavery forever in the United States a reality. So I say in both chapters that Lincoln could never have issued the Emancipation Proclamation and then prosecuted the war to end slavery. The Emancipation Proclamation effectively changed the terms of the Civil War to be a war about abolition as well as a war about national unity. And nor could he have enacted the 13th Amendment, which we all know from Spielberg's brilliant movie on Lincoln, you know, was a pivotal, you know, a touchstone piece of legislation for Lincoln and for the country. He couldn't have done that without all the work that Frederick Douglass had done at a grassroots level with all kinds of Northerners, white and black, elite politicians, journalists, as well as ordinary citizens, without the kind of momentum that Douglass had built in terms of changing political opinion about slavery. So you really, the story of slavery ending is very much a story of both men working from two different parts of the American polity toward what became a common end, right? Douglass long wants to end slavery. Takes Lincoln, you know, it takes Lincoln a couple of years as president to really come to embrace abolition in the way he does. But this is a story of two men, one black, one white, one born a slave, one born a hardscrabble farmer's son, who really changed the country and the world in what they did.
Why start with Shackleton?
Well, first of all, because the story's so unbelievable. Even if you know it, the story of this explorer, right, who loses his ship and is left with 27 men, some canned goods, and three rowboats drifting on an iceberg off the coast of Antarctica, left to get them all home alive in 1915. It's just so incredible. So firstly, you start with it because the story is so against all odds that it makes your jaw drop, even if you know it. Second, it's a story of extraordinary ingenuity and of his ability, Shackleton, to keep summoning up within himself the will to accomplish this mission. And that will, the ability to access that and then communicate it to his men, had an enormous amount to do with their collective belief that their leader, they called him the boss, could get them home alive. So it's such a stark story as well. It's set against literally the complete white, right, of Antarctica. No line on the horizon. And it's so, the issues of leadership are so clear because they're so stark and because the stakes live or die, are so very high. So for all those reasons, we start with the most dramatic of the stories, Ernest Shackleton.
And that sets a tone, doesn't it, though? It also really sets the pace as to what you're looking at.
It does. And I, to be very, very candid, I wanted to grab the reader, just grab them by the hand and say, look, this is what you're in for. This is about what it takes to make yourself into a great leader. But this is not about reading a bunch of dry lessons or memorizing a bunch of historical facts. This is about gripping human drama. And the triumph in each of these cases of the human spirit when it's harnessed to goodness. And so I thought, what better way to pull the reader in and try and keep him or her with me than to start with this story?
So then we go to Bonhoeffer. So at what point did you think it was important to bring this story in? And because I will say, out of all of the stories, this was the one that I probably knew the least about.
Well, I think you're in very good company, Joe. Most Americans, at least in my informal but persistent canvas, have never heard of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And many Europeans haven't. He is well known on the grapevine today among all kinds of spiritual communities and many Christian communities as well for his theological work. But the chapter isn't about that, as you know. The chapter is about his work as a clergyman who was initially resisting Hitler through an alternative church in Germany and then becomes an active member of the resistance and a double agent working within the Nazi government to try and overthrow the Third Reich and assassinate Hitler. And I discovered the story like a child bumping into a hot stove. I just stumbled on it in 2006 when I was doing research on leaders who made a huge difference, again, against all odds and in the face of very dramatic forces, in this case, the force of the Nazi government. And so I stumbled on it, and I just started unpacking it. All his papers are in English. There are about 5 extraordinary biographies written about him. And once I got into the story, I realized this wasn't only a story of an extraordinarily courageous person who made himself into a very effective individual against great evil, but also the story of how to live very thoughtfully and mindfully and decently when the world is very turbulent and when moral standards are precarious. And then last but not least, it turns out to be a great spy story. I didn't know that, right? The drama of the last half of the chapter, again, is spellbinding. And so once I discover with my nose for what I thought would be a very compelling narrative, there was no getting me away from it. So he is the least well-known, but his story is, I think, as rich as any of the other 4.
You discussed at the beginning of our conversation of where you were personally that got you thinking about this idea of crisis and leadership and how you get through turbulent times. So at the end of writing these 5 sections, how do you feel?
It's a great question. Thank you for asking it. These people have taught me a lot, probably more than I've been able to offer the reader, but I hope I've offered the reader, you know, all kinds of diamonds in the rough that they can use in these stories for their own lives and their own missions. But what I've learned from these people is a number of things. Let me just give you 3 of the most important lessons, which, by the way, I still draw on. You know, I'll wake up nervous because I'm going in for a medical checkup. Mm-hmm. And I'll think of Shackleton, you know, squaring his shoulders, tightening his core, and walking out onto the ice from his tent every day. Or I'll get really anxious from something on my email, and I'll think of how Lincoln always slowed himself down when the emotional stakes in him and around him got very high. He always moved more slowly. He never, ever acted in the heat of the emotional moment. Or I'll think about Rachel Carson and how brave she was as she battled breast cancer. And I'll say, come on, Nancy. She battled demons bigger than yours. You can be brave, too. So I would say these people have taught me a lot, mostly from the inside out, but some from the outside in. And I also, I should say last but not least, fell in love with each of them. So I love them dearly, and they have comforted me as well as educated me.
The name of the book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Nancy Kane, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing with us. I so appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for making the time.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Forged in Crisis. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.